Good morning. Please be seated. The first case on the Supreme Court's oral argument calendar today is the City of North Las Vegas v. Lazario Ruiz, case number 63320. Before we begin, counsel, it's my understanding we have some guests here today. Mr. Naftali from the Adelson campus, would you please stand up? How are you? These are your students. Yes. Would all of the students with the Adelson campus please stand up? Thank you all very much for coming. We appreciate your presence here today. I know you're going all over the building to various other activities and seeing other judges. If you have time to stay after this presentation, we'll take a few minutes, the court will, and give you an opportunity to ask questions of the justices, and we'd like to share a few comments with you, too, about being on the Supreme Court if you have time to stay. Thank you all for being with us today. Thank you. Be seated. Okay, counsel, as if there isn't enough pressure to do a good job in front of the Supreme Court, you now have a group of students who are anxiously awaiting your words. Okay? Mr. Eccles?
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, Micah Eccles for Appellant, City of North Las Vegas. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. This is a case that concerns the Peace Officer's Bill of Rights in NRS Chapter 689. And the case was before the court before, in which the court determined that Mr. Ruiz had individual standing under 689.120 to challenge the arbitration decision. The specific instructions on remand were to challenge the arbitration decision. And I suppose the threshold question is, what's the proper standard of review, which was raised in the answering brief, for the term that's used in the statute, .120, judicial relief? What exactly does that mean? We actually agree with the district court that identified the common law standards of review, arbitrary, capricious, supported by the agreement, and the manifest disregard of the law. What we disagree with is how she applied those standards. One thing that 689.120 definitely is not, it definitely is not license for a peace officer to file a brand new independent action as if nothing in the administrative part of the case ever happened. And that's what my opponent argues in the answering brief. That's bad policy for a number of reasons. First, if it means that they get to start over as if nothing ever happened, any collective bargaining agreement involving a peace officer would essentially be null and void so long as they asserted a defense of 689 rights, Peace Officer Bill of Rights. Not surprisingly, we have seen a lot of those defenses come up in cases since Ruiz. Hey, everything is a violation of my rights under Chapter 689. What we'd ask the court to do is agree with the district court that the common law standards of review are in play, and if they are, here's why we win. Clark County Education Association only required that there be a reasoned decision. In this case, we have a 27-page decision from the arbitrator. He weighed the evidence, he considered what the witnesses had to say, he issued a reasoned decision, and he agreed that termination was appropriate on two grounds, untruthfulness and unprofessional conduct. On the manifest disregard of the law,
yes, Your Honor. As to that, and I guess we have an issue as to whether or not that crucial statement, his statement, should have been admitted in the first place.
Okay.
Because he was not apprised of that 48-hour written notice before any interview can take place. You want to talk about that a little bit, set the tone?
Certainly, Your Honor. That right that that Ruiz says he should have been given 48 hours notice is 689.060. That statute generally applies to administrative investigations. So it would be if they were questioning his employment. In this case, what we have is a hybrid, which in the district court order, it recognizes this is a hybrid administrative and criminal investigation.
Does our law recognize it hybrid?
It does, Your Honor, implicitly, according to 689.090, which is the exception that we raised both in the arbitration, which the arbitrator agreed with us on that point, raised it in the district court. And the interesting point is, even though we feel that 689.090 is the controlling authority on that entire issue, Your Honor, it's not even mentioned in the district court order.
Mr. Eccles, I appreciate you starting your argument with a review, standard of review, because this statute puts us, I think, in a murky area.
Mm-hmm.
It could have some other provisions that would help all of us work through this. But is the issue of whether this proceeding hybrid or administrative or criminal a de novo legal determination, or is it one that is fact and law bound? And what is our standard of review on that point alone? Seems like that's a threshold question.
I think, Your Honor, in our standards of review in our opening brief, we cited some cases in there about standards of review. And we have one in there that says statutory interpretation, even in the context of an injunction appeal, is still a de novo review.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think this court would look at the district court's order de novo, particularly because we're dealing with statutory interpretation.
So on the question of whether this is a hybrid investigation, that is, the police officer is being investigated for some administrative misconduct,
mm-hmm.
or conduct that might also be criminal in nature, what's the basis for suggesting this is hybrid? I don't see anywhere in any of this where this officer has been subjected to a criminal investigation as we would normally see it in a criminal prosecution. Was he ever identified as a suspect? Was he ever viewed as a potential defendant? Has he ever asserted any Miranda rights? I mean, where is the indicia that this investigation would lead this court to conclude that it's even a hybrid investigation?
And to answer your question, I think I need to go back to the language of 689.090.
Mm-hmm.
And that it says, any investigation that concerns allegations of criminal activities. And so he doesn't necessarily need to be the target of the criminal investigation. All it needs to be is something that he's concerned with. And we actually agree with what the district court determined. The district court said of the four statements that Mr. Ruiz gave, the first one was mainly criminal but had a little bit of administrative in it, and said the second two were almost purely criminal because they were done at the station. He was Mirandized on that evening when he went to the station. And then the fourth statement is almost purely administrative. And so if you're trying to figure out, okay, if you put a timeline together and say, here's kind of where it begins and where it ends, it's kind of the middle that's purely criminal and then the edges of the first and the fourth.
I'd like to test the breadth of your interpretation of the statute.
Okay.
Wouldn't it be the case that any officer who's questioned, if you interpret the statute the way you're suggesting,
mm-hmm.
whether that officer is the subject or potential subject of criminal misconduct, or whether it involves a crime committed by somebody else, would mean, I mean, that's what officers do. They investigate crimes. So that wouldn't that eviscerate the statute, even though an officer is being questioned about something in which he's not or she is not the target, since they're engaged in, you know, chasing suspects and arresting people, if they're questioned, there'd be a hybrid investigation. How do you address that?
And I see your point there, Your Honor, and I think this case is unique because the reason why Ruiz got involved in the first place is because of 689.020(3) that said where the police department learned that he had information about this robbery, and they called him to the scene. That's where we got the pushback. It took him 51 minutes to get there. But it says that he has to comply with the a criminal investigation, or he could face insubordination. And that's where some of the statements come from.
Is there anything in this record that indicates that any of the investigating officers, any of the interrogating officers, ever considered Ruiz a suspect in a criminal case?
I think yes, Your Honor. There's Sergeant Snyder, Sergeant Crespo, who were the officers that were at the scene. Mm-hmm. They were calling Ruiz, say, hey, bring your brother back to the scene. In their notes that are part of the arbitration record, they said he might be a suspect. And in fact, when they brought him back to the station on the evening of the incident, they Mirandized him for the fact that, hey, he might be a suspect in this. We just don't know, because you started out with his written statement, and it raised a lot of issues of maybe he was involved in this. The arbitrator made the determination towards the end of his decision, hey, you know, he might have been an accessory to this thing because he was standing right there. Mm-hmm. And so the arbitrator concluded that, in fact, he was a suspect and had kind of set the factual underpinnings for that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. So moving beyond the statute, and I kind of already talked about the arbitrary and capricious standard, if you look at the manifest disregard standard, you know, one of the things that the district court did is they said that the four statements all had to be suppressed under 689.085. The court said that all of his four statements were taken in violation of 060, with the exception of the fourth statement, which is the fruits of the poisonous tree. Now, the interesting thing about that fourth statement is, if you go back and look at the motion in limine that was filed in the arbitration, they don't ask to exclude that fourth statement. The union was perfectly fine to allow that fourth statement in. And in fact, that fourth statement is really the most substantive, because it was admittedly done in compliance with 060. He had at least 48 hours written notice. He was there with his attorney, with his representative. And so, kind of going down the logical chain, we don't believe that there was a manifest disregard of the law. And then if you look at the language of 689.085, it kind of provides a parallel construction. It talks about a court, or it talks about an arbitrator or a court. And it's a broadly written statute to apply to all types of labor disputes. And then it talks about... it says for an arbitrator, then it says an administrative proceeding, and then it says or a civil case against a peace officer. It doesn't talk about a peace officer coming into court as a petitioner. It's talking about an original action. For example, the city sues an individual police officer in court for whatever claim it may be, and then there's the suppression rule. But what it does not allow a court of law to do is to go back and look at an administrative hearing like an arbitrator that the statute makes parallel, and second-guess those. It's our position that would violate the manifest disregard, because manifest disregard standard, we don't second-guess the law. We don't second-guess facts for sure. But to go back and look at suppression arguments is just beyond the scope of review that the district court even had. I will leave the remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Eccles, before you leave the podium, could you make a record of your associate who's present with you as well?
Oh, thank you. This is Jamie Frost from our office.
All right, Ms. Frost.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Levin, there you go.
I am, Your Honor.
All right.
May it please the Court, Adam Levine for Respondent Lazaro Ruiz, who is present in the audience. Also present with me is Daniel Marks from our office.
Good morning, Mr. Marks.
Good morning.
I'd like to start with an argument that I heard being made by the appellant that it's 289.120, not 689, I think he just misspoke, that somehow the statute doesn't authorize a new action, and that's bad policy. It is the legislature that sets policy, And 289.120 does authorize specifically an independent action. It doesn't speak in terms of judicial review, such as under the Administrative Procedures Act. It says judicial relief. And the statute specifically provides that an officer may bring an action for extraordinary or injunctive relief. It's an independent action. Extraordinary relief is commonly referred to as mandamus or prohibition, and also for injunctive relief. So the statute specifically, and the legislature has provided, for an independent action. And that independent action cannot be brought until all administrative and contractual remedies are exhausted, because that statute provides that you can't bring it until you exhaust your contractual options, which would include arbitration. So at the outset, it must be understood that there is an independent action, and that what Ruiz brought after this court previously determined, the last time it was before you, that he had exhausted his contractual and administrative remedies. I would like to emphasize that the outcome of this case does not turn on the standard of review, that Lozario Ruiz should prevail under either standard. It's our position that the district court made an error in deciding it under the standards applicable to arbitrage decisions, arbitrary and capricious and manifest disregard of the law. It should be a de novo review. And the reason is because the statute does not distinguish between courts and arbitrators. 289.085, which is the civil exclusionary rule, says that a court or an arbitrator shall exclude evidence, prejudicial evidence obtained in violation of the statute. It doesn't distinguish and set one standard for arbitrators and one standard for courts. It is a legislative directive. Such evidence shall be excluded. Now, the issue of the standard of review has been addressed under California's equivalent, which is the model for Nevada's Peace Officer Bill of Rights. California takes the position that independent actions under the Peace Officer's Bill of Rights rests in the sound discretion of the trial court and won't be reversed unless the court has exceeded all bounds of reason or contravened uncontradicted evidence. A manifest disregard standard is always a de novo standard of review, but what we're dealing with is a civil exclusionary rule.
Is there not a difference between Nevada and California law?
Substantively, I don't believe there is, and I've addressed that in my brief. I don't believe there is a substantive difference between the two as far as what is implicated in this case. California has amended their statutes and now allows damages and attorney's fees, which would be nice if Nevada did, but we're not there yet. But as far as
we talk about hybrid situation?
The statute doesn't address in California hybrid. It is the case law that addresses hybrid and recognizes that hybrid investigations are covered by the Act, because as the California court recognized in the California Correction Officers Association versus State of California, virtually any administrative investigation could be recast as criminal so as to circumvent and avoid the protections of the Act.
I assume you would agree with your colleague there that the determination of whether this investigation and in other cases going forward is a legal question, not a factual question.
It is
viewed de novo.
I agree. Now, I do want to address something that Your Honor inquired of Mr. Eccles, that isn't it the job of peace officers to investigate crimes? And I think I gave you an example in my answer in brief. Suppose a robbery detective decides to not pursue a lead, not do a follow-up, and go, say, to a donut shop on his own time. Well, that would be misconduct, but technically it's a criminal case, and that results in the statute being an absurdity. The statute clearly contemplates, and I think I cited the legislative history of the 1983 amendments, that is the peace officer, when the peace officer is the subject of a criminal investigation, the protections of the Act don't apply.
Okay, so let's take this case rather than the donut shop example. In this instance, if my memory is correct, your client's Miranda warnings were provided prior to the second interview, I think. Is that right?
It was. However, let's be very clear, and I'm going to cite you to the provisions in the record. He was not a suspect. When he was at the scene, Sergeant Snyder testified, and I will give you the citation to the record, that her questioning at the scene was administrative. It was at 1043 of the appendix. Mm-hmm. Likewise, Lieutenant DeMauro came out. Lieutenant DeMauro stated that at the time he came out and ordered Ruiz to the station, Ruiz was not a suspect, and that's at 1314 in the record. Remember, if he's a suspect, they can, of course, under NRS 171-123, detain him for up to, I think it's 60 minutes at the scene, and question him, but that's not what happened. Rather, they used the coercive threat of discipline to force him off duty, in violation of the statute, to go to the Southern Area Command and wait. Then, they put him in a room, and they had two robbery detectives come in. And it was at that point they Mirandized him. What they didn't tell him was Internal Affairs had already been summoned at the directive of Assistant Chief Chronister and was surreptitiously monitoring that interrogation by a closed-circuit camera. Now, they didn't give him a Miranda, but under the circumstances, an officer who knows he's not a suspect in a crime would have no reason not to talk to the detectives. However, if they tell him, oh, by the way, do you see that? Internal Affairs is watching. Then, of course, he's going to say, I want my union representative. It should be emphasized that, and this didn't arise in the case, that if he had been charged with a crime, anything they had taken from him in that interview would not have been admissible anyway because it would have violated Garrity. And, of course, the district court noted that Garrity was violated because he was there answering the questions under coercive direction of threat to his job.
So the legal analysis, what is your proposed analysis that would be included in an opinion that would give guidance to future district court judges as to the factors they should consider when determining whether the investigation is administrative, criminal, or hybrid? I take it you would say that just because someone's Miranda rights have been provided isn't determinative.
That is
we should look at other factors.
That is absolutely correct. And this is where I think the California precedent is directly on point and very well reasoned, which is California has addressed this in numerous cases. And in the City of Berkeley case, they reiterated their prior decisions, which is if the officer is there, wherever he is, be it Internal Affairs, the Berkeley Police Review Commission in that particular case, in front of the Department of Justice in the California Corrections Officer case that I cited, if the officer is there because he is ordered to be there and answer questions under threat of discipline, then the act applies. Because as the California court recognized in City of Los Angeles versus Superior Court, and again in Van Winkle, if an officer can be questioned on a subject which could lead to punitive action, and their definition of punitive action is the exact same as ours, by a superior officer without the protections of the act is rendered meaningless, and I think they use the word it eviscerates the protections of the act. And the California court in Van Winkle said it is the role of the, in that case, Superior Court, our case, District Court, to decide when questioning, routine questioning begins to shade into an investigation covered by the act, or when an investigator is acting in collusion with Internal Affairs or a dual capacity. That's the language used by the California courts. It is a de novo legal determination for the court to make based upon the facts of the case.
Could you address, I'm sure you have other things you wanted to visit about, but within the time here, could you address why the court should exclude or revisit the fourth statement in this case? Just factually, and maybe for the benefit of students, your client gave four statements, three of which were relatively close in time, and the fourth one was much later in time.
Yes, and this was a key point that I was intending to address, so I will address it now. Mr. Eccles is mistaken when he states that the union motion in limine did not address the fourth statement. It does, and I will tell you where in the record that can be found. What happened is there was a difference in the way the statements were counted. When you look at it in the union's motion in limine, they refer to the statement compelled on the voluntary witness form at the scene as statement number one, the interviews by the robbery detectives as statement number two, and then the subsequent interview by Internal Affairs in November as statement number three. The district court counted them different. Statement number one at the scene on the voluntary form, but recognized there are actually two different statements taken by the robbery detectives, one at 1 a.m., one at 2 a.m. So she called that two and three, and then what the union called the third statement in November by Internal Affairs, the district court called the fourth statement. But to claim that the union did not object to that was false. As the union pointed out in its motion in limine, it cited the Missouri versus Siebert case, which was a Miranda case that says you can't violate a suspect's Miranda rights and then go back later, re-Mirandize them, and use the statement that was previously taken. The reason that the district court found that last statement by Internal Affairs taken much later to be the fruit of the poisonous tree was a recognition by the California courts that an officer may be too inexperienced or too inarticulate to make a proper statement on their own behalf when they don't have representation. That was specifically found, I believe it was in the Van Winkle case, as to why such statements should be suppressed. So if a statement is taken from an officer who may be too inexperienced or too inarticulate to give the statement he needs to give and would otherwise give with the benefit of representation, it defeats the purpose of the statute to go back later and give him the notice and then use that subsequent statement, because as pointed out very aptly by the union's attorney, that if you make a different statement later to Internal Affairs than the earlier statement taken in violation of the act, you then open yourself up to a charge of changing your statement and an accusation potentially of being untruthful.
What does your argument lead, though? I see the tension between your two positions, and you're saying that Mr. Eccles' reading would eviscerate the statute because it enlarges the exception and makes it boundless for criminal investigation. But look at it from the other side. What does yours lead that statute to do? I'm trying to envision a situation under your argument where you could have a statement from a police officer before the 48 hours have run. There may be a crime going on, there may not be, they're trying to find out. When would that statement ever not be subject to the Police Officer Protection Act? Under your reading of that, what's the standard?
And this is the same issue that has been addressed by the California courts and aptly recognized. Routine questioning doesn't implicate the Peace Officer's Bill of Rights. It is only questioning on a subject which could lead to punitive action. And, of course, at the scene when he's there, he was threatened with punitive action. And I think that I hope that.
So is it the threat of punitive action that changes this in
your
mind?
The subject matter of the questioning could lead to punitive action against the peace officer. The statute says that you must give. It's not just 48 hours notice. Remember.
Right, but you're slowing down an investigation. I mean, there's a policy argument on the other side of this as well, and I get that we don't make the policy, the legislature does. But my concern is, a police officer who may be implicated in criminal activity, may be a participant in it, in that situation, won't that always presage some problem of punitive action?
No.
Administratively? Why not?
Because as recognized in the Van Winkle case, the way you do it is you identify, as they did in Van Winkle, you tell them, this is a criminal investigation. Or you tell them, this is a criminal investigation. This is not a subject that is going to lead to punitive action. And I must emphasize, 289.060 doesn't just require 48 hours notice and the information that you have a right to two representatives. It requires notice as to the nature of the misconduct and specifically the nature of the investigation. Subsection C of the statute says the department must tell them about the nature of the investigation. In the Van Winkle case, I'm over my time, but in the Van Winkle case, there was no protection because the officer was clearly told this is a criminal investigation. In this particular case, Ruiz was not told
But is that the distinguishing feature? I didn't mean to interrupt.
Yes.
And in your mind, is the statement this is criminal versus this is...
Right. In other words, in a... What implicates the Peace Officer's Bill of Rights, as recognized in the Berkeley case, was the coercive nature of having to be there to answer questions. If North Las Vegas robbery says, "Lads, you're off duty, but we're going to call you in, we're going to call you back to duty, we're going to pay you for your time, we want your assistance," that's one thing. Then he's assisting with a criminal investigation. That's not what happened. He is called on his day off, he's not paid, and he is coerced into making statements under threats of discipline, and that's what the California courts have recognized implicates the act.
Before you sit down, I have one other question that I think is important regarding the use of the doctrine of the fruit of the poisonous tree to evaluate the inadmissibility of the fourth statement. In Miranda, applying Miranda principles, generally speaking, a suspect who has been questioned in violation of their Miranda rights can be questioned again if that mistake is corrected later and correct Miranda rights have been given or the defendant themselves initiates a statement. Why wouldn't a correct notice cure the previous errors? Why wouldn't we take a different view of the Miranda approach and the fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine in this case, which only applies, by the way, in administrative proceedings anyway?
First, the California courts in the Perez case recognized that the fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine is appropriate to utilize under the Peace Officer Bill of Rights.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that you can't cure, under the facts of this case, a statement that is taken in violation of the act. Remember, when he is in November given a written notice in compliance with the statute, he doesn't know that the department already has a secret recording of his prior statement.
And why not if it's excluded?
I'm sorry?
Why not if it's excluded and can't be used?
Because if he changes his testimony in any material way, he is opening himself up to a charge of dishonesty. Just to emphasize how important this is.
That's what I'm trying to understand. How is that possible when the statement's been suppressed? That in a criminal context, where there's a Miranda violation, the statement is suppressed.
It is suppressed in front of a court or an arbitrator. But remember, he's going to get fired before it gets there because the department is going to say, "I believe you've changed your testimony or therefore dishonest, and so you're going to get fired." And just so you understand how, because remember, the exclusion rule applies to a court or an arbitrator.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that under NAC 289.110, if you are terminated for dishonesty, you cannot be employed as a peace officer in this state. You are barred. And that's why the significance is such that, unlike Miranda, if a prior statement is taken and you cannot materially change your subsequent statement without opening yourself up to a charge of dishonesty, which is career-ending, you can't just go back and, after surreptitiously monitoring an officer by hidden camera, they're going to now give you the notice and make you say it again.
Okay. Are there any other questions by my colleagues? Yes. Justice Douglas.
Based upon what the district court did, was there anything that should have gone back? The district court's finding in this matter remanded back to the district court as to the unprofessional?
No. If you look at the record, we asked the district court to order him reinstated because the undisputed evidence, including the testimony from Oscar, nobody could say that Nazario Ruiz saw the chains being taken, and since nobody could testify to it, there's nothing to go back. The district court was unwilling to go that far. She said, "I'm suppressing the statements and the truthfulness charge, which is based on those statements. However, an arbitrator should evaluate whether or not there is enough evidence of unprofessional conduct to sustain any discipline." So, no, I think the district court got it right, if that answers your question. There is one point, if I might be allowed to make, which I think is very, very important on the manifest disregard of the law and why that should not be the standard. It would create an absurdity because, think about it, you have peace officers covered by the statute employed by the Department of Public Safety, which is the state, UNLV, and other Nevada Department of Corrections. They don't get arbitrations. They get a hearing in front of a hearing officer where the manifest disregard of the law standard doesn't apply. So you would essentially, to adopt their argument, be creating two different standards under the statute depending upon who the employer is, and I don't think that was the intent of the legislature.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Green. Please add 2 minutes to Mr. Eccles' time.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll address his last argument first. Our argument is not that we're asking the court to apply a manifest disregard standard to all determinations that are made at the administrative level for purposes of 289.120, but we're just asking for arbitrations. We shouldn't alter the standard of review that we already have in place for common law. That's really an open question of if you have certain officers or peace officers who do not go to arbitration under their collective bargaining agreement or administrative process, what standard of review do those read? That's an issue for another case, but we're not suggesting that they should all be the same standard. Just to follow up on a couple of points, there's a key statute here that my opponent's missing. 289.020(3) compelled Ruiz to go back to the scene because he had actual knowledge of what happened there or face insubordination. That's right in the statute. There was really not a reason for an administrative investigation to him at that point. There was definitely a criminal investigation. There was a robbery that took place. There were witnesses. There was Oscar Talamantes who had the gold chain yanked from his neck. But the statute, because it was known that Officer Ruiz had information, he was compelled to cooperate. And that was his threat that's put right in the statute. That's not anything that was done other than what's right there. My opponent is talking about...
What is the citation again?
It's NRS 289.020(3), Your Honor.
Thank you, sir.
My opponent's talked about Garrity rights, and he's kind of at different points in the briefing said, well, the statute in .060 essentially codifies what are the Garrity rights outlined by the Supreme Court of the United States. Now, there's an interesting case that cuts into the Garrity rights and actually supports the city's position, and that's Gardner versus Broderick. We cited it in our opening and our reply briefs. And there's another line of cases that kind of elaborates on this Gardner standard, Lingo versus Fetchko and U.S. versus Camacho, also cited in our briefs. But basically what these cases talk about, they say, okay, you have a peace officer that may be involved or may have information in a crime, and so you have this hybrid administrative criminal situation like we have in this case. And it says if the employer questions that individual, they have to choose. Either they can go for the administrative remedies if they believe there's something there, or they can go for the criminal remedies, but they can't go for both. You can't compel somebody to answer on the administrative side and use those statements in violation of the Fifth Amendment. In this case, nobody's prosecuted Ruiz for any of his statements. But those cases, we feel like those are the three main cases that kind of provide the framework of how the court should read the 060 rights with 090. On the fruit of the poisonous tree argument, if we go back to...
Well, at what point do they have to declare where they're headed? I mean, Mr. Levine makes the point that he distinguishes our situation in this case from others where it was said, we're looking at this as a criminal matter or we're looking at this as an administrative matter where the employer declared. Here, your employer is sort of hedging his bet until they decide which way to go.
And I can see your point, Your Honor. When he was Mirandized, he had the right to remain silent, and he could have at that point. And that's where Ruiz would have taken his position. And what it allows the city to do is it allowed the city to go forward as both a hybrid criminal and administrative, but then because they had gone beyond that point, then they couldn't prosecute him criminally because they had compelled statements from him that could have been used against him.
Well, that seems a little awkward. Don't you have to at some point tell the subject, we're going to chase you criminally or we're going to chase you administratively? I mean, that seems like an awkward, undisclosed dance, really.
It is. In these three cases, in particular the Camacho case, kind of sets forward this strange kind of dance that it is, Your Honor.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure that we shouldn't make it clear when you get to dance. Okay, thanks, Mr. Eckert.